Anyway, on this day in 1984, the Cars released this song, as Steve said, from their Heartbeat City album. Upon its release, it became the Cars' highest charting single. Now, the Cars were formed in Boston in 1976, emerging from the new wave scene in the late 70s. They were at the forefront of the merger of 1970s guitar rock with the new synth-orientated pop that became popular in the early 80s. They received huge airplay with their tightly produced hits like this, Drive, or You Might Think, and Magic. And producer Robert Mutt Lange, his commitment to the Cars meant that he told Def Leppard he couldn't work on their new album Hysteria, but was eventually able to produce it. So a little bit of music history there. Quite contemporary sound in a way, Mary Margaret, as well.
I like the synth elements.
Yeah, that's right. The synth sort of coming in.
When was Blue Monday a thing?
This is Steve's topic. That's actually Salford, my hometown.
You are kidding.
No, Peter Hook is from Broughton. That's literally where I come from. Seriously,
deserves a little fist bump. Doesn't it?
No, I'm afraid
that deserves a fist bump.
I don't know personally, but what's his name? What's the singer's? I can't think of his. I could picture him now. I can't think of his name. But yeah, from Salford, my hometown. I'm ashamed I can't think of Bernard Sumner is another Salford lad.
That was
83, I think it was New Order.
Well, Blue Monday. You surprise me every time, Steve.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Steve, a bit of response for you. But Wallace, I accrued 66 days sick leave over 17 years, and when my partner had a critical illness, which resulted in him being in hospital for 6 months, I was able to use this leave to be with him every day for 4 of those months by using my sick leave as family leave. I would have quit my job if I hadn't had that as the situation and was so dire. It was an act of compassion, so kia ora Jenny for that, I appreciate it. Helga in Sandringham says, go panellists! With a very small number of exceptions, people don't abuse sick leave in workplaces where they are trusted and valued. Another one here, Wallace, I find it difficult to believe you came from a Christian minister's household with your distrust of ordinary human beings. You're a disgrace. And Rosen, Lancashire, UK, said, I just listened to... Someone's listening from Lancashire.
All the best folk from Lancashire, really.
I love the panel. Great radio, says Samantha in Lancashire. And I just listened to Steve. Fantastic. As another Northern Englander, I can't catch his accent. Sorry, can't disguise that accent. He made me smile with his to-the-point and honest opinions. No beating around the bush with that boy. Used to the media politicising COVID, we should all be against this killer. So, Samantha, I really hope you're doing well in the UK, or as well as you can be.
Yeah, Southern Lancashire, Blackburn, Bolton, towns like that have been the absolute epicentre lately. It's a nightmare. Yeah. So best of luck to you. Kia ora, love.
A top Auckland restaurant is to add an optional service fee to the bill. Will others follow? As Stuffed reports, Ed Verner, owner chef at Auckland's acclaimed pasture, is leading the charge to normalise service charges in New Zealand by adding an optional 5% surcharge to his restaurant's bills. Some have feared that this is just a step towards a form of tipping culture. Others, though, have called it an innovative approach. So an extra 5% service charge, which would be optional to be shared amongst the staff. With us now is Mike Egan, who is the National President of the Restaurant Association and owner of restaurant Monsoon Poon. Mike, yada.
Yada.
Quite an interesting model. It is said to be, by one of the co-owners at this stage, to be an 85-15 split, 85% of that charge to the staff. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I've never heard of it before in this country. Obviously, it's common in London, and I don't think it works that well in London. I don't really see it catching on, especially in the short term. But pasta is an unusual restaurant. It only seats 6 people, so it's quite unusual.
I don't think that's right, actually. We talked to the... we had an email from the owners. I think they said it's set over 20, actually.
Okay. I just read the stuff article.
Sure, yeah. But look, they said the surcharge was necessary because the current model of 30% food costs, 30% beverage costs, and 30% staff costs quite just doesn't work. Maybe it's an old model.
Well, I mean, if they're getting 30% wage cost, hats off to them. We operate on nearly 40% because, of pay increases and all the rest of it. So 30% is, I would suggest, is a pretty good wage cost for a business like theirs. So I'm not quite sure whether that's the new model.
Mary Margaret, what do you think?
So that means their workers are getting a fair wage?
I'm not sure. I'll have to look at their books. But, yeah, I mean, their cheque average is like $500, $400, according to the article. So if you extrapolate that out, 30% of that, you could sort of do the numbers. It wouldn't be too hard to work out.
Sure.
You know, they're making money.
I saw Chloe Ann King warning that this would normalise subsidising poverty wages, and I think that's a very good precaution.
Mike?
Yeah, I think that's quite extreme. You know, our plumber charges service charge on a Sunday of $180 if you call them out. Other businesses do charge wage service charges at different times of the...
I guess the real point there was either do something like this as an option, and I'd be interested to hear the listeners, would you be willing to pay, and I've got to stress it's optional, but would you be willing to pay a 5% service fee charge on top of your bill? The other one is lifting those wages, Mike Egan.
Yeah, that's right. Again, it's really hard to comment without actually having a proper chat to them. I mean, it's a bit of a storm in a teacup. It's one little restaurant in Auckland, and I've never heard anyone even contemplating a service charge here. So
it's quite a right, okay, Steve.
Well, there's two different ways of attacking this one. The first hand, I think Mary Margaret's going to be on board with me in this one when I say that if your business model does not include paying your staff a fair living wage, then your business model is deeply flawed and you've got no business being in business.
Yep.
But at the same time also, I've lived in the US for long enough to see what tipping looks like, and it is horrendous. It is the most grossly arbitrary, random, unfair, capricious way of paying your workers or avoiding paying your workers.
It's rewarding good service.
No,
that's what it's doing.
No,
I've been to New York and I reward a great service, Steve McCabe.
No, it's not. What it does is it provides massive amounts of wage insecurity. No wait staff who go into their shift know how much they're going to make. If you don't feel like tipping, then they don't get paid. There is no obligation for you to pay them whatsoever. There is massive inequity. Research shows that young, attractive white women get paid massively more tips than anybody else. People who work weekends get bigger tips than people who work during the week for the same shift and the same work. And so that, for example, young mothers who can't work weekends, they've got kids, but they can only work during the week, they're immediately disadvantaged. Two okay. people working the same shift, one working a table where some bloke orders a cup of coffee and a dozen refills, is going to get rubbish tips. Somebody else works the same work but brings one big plate and a drink to that table, he's going to get a much bigger tip. This is not a path we want to go down. It's right. a horrendous system.
Let's go back to Mike. Thoughts, Mike?
I 100% agree with his research. I mean, that is exactly what happens in America. And he's exactly right. We don't want to have that here. Most of us and the members are working towards a living wage if we're not already there. I would suggest that, you know, a huge number of the kitchens are on a living wage at least. And the tipping here is sort of minor, $3 or $4 an hour on average that the staff get on top of their living wage. And it's just a nice thing to have, but no one relies on it. They use it for, you know, a bit of extra money. The students, you know, use it for going out on Friday night. We definitely do not want to follow the American model whatsoever. It is exactly as you described.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for that. Mike is the National President of the Restaurant Association and owner of Restaurant Monsoon Poon. No, hang on, Steve, I want to hear what Mary Margaret has to say. In terms of, and I'm not suggesting this anyway as part of a tipping culture, it's, as Mike says, he's never heard of it before, but would you just like the chance to reward some... Would you tip?
No, because we don't have a tipping culture and it's a good thing that we don't. I worked in hospital very recently and I would much prefer my wages being regulated.
Mm.
I wouldn't leave it in the hands of anyone else.
Mm.
But if we're rewarding good service, what? If we want to do it on that basis, yeah. Why limit it to hospital? Why not do it to, for example, radio presenters? so your boss, whoever that may be,
telling me to put out a bank account number for all our listeners to tip me?
No, not tip you, but because remember, wait staff in the US don't make minimum wage.
Mm, yeah.
They make a pittance as a base and then they have to top it up.
Understood.
So what we'll do is we'll pay you a tenth of your current salary, and then folk, if they reckon you've done a good show today, then they can chip in and they'll reward good service, won't they, mate?
Well, that's ridiculous.
Of course it is. Thank you. You make my point for me.
I will share one lovely anecdote from when I used to work at Daily Bread. There was a woman who came in every week to get her bread, and she caught wind of the fact that I was on BFM at the time. And she used to tip me $20 every single time and said, put it towards your research for The Wire. And she was lovely.
Oh, that's sweet.
Kia ora to that person. Someone says, Steve's on fire today. You got some fans today, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Which doesn't happen often here on the panel.
It's got the Friday flair.
Yeah, exactly.
Friday flair.
D-mob happy.
I suggest you move to America, Wallace. People are hating on me today, for goodness sake. I'm just saying that if you have great service in Aotearoa, you go to and for whatever reason you're having a great time, what is wrong with putting a bit more down on the bill?
I'm just saying, is a lovely way to disguise being devil's advocate, isn't it?
I'm just saying. Anyway,
just say. I'll remember that.
I went to a restaurant last night in Auckland, and they did ask for that charge to be added voluntarily, but I didn't really understand what they were talking about. I now feel a little guilty because the person looked quite sad. Maybe his pay is quite low, says Diane. You're on the panel, NZ National. I'm Wallace Chapman. Lovely to be with you this afternoon. 15 to 5, Steve McCabe and Mary Margaret Slapp is with me this afternoon. This is very interesting, this article. Timothy Welch in The Conversation writes, something strange has happened to the perception of cyclists and cycling in the more than 200 years they've been around. Once a novelty, bike riding has moved from being a critical transport mode to a children's pastime to now being popularly perceived as an elitist activity. Ask most people what a cyclist looks like, and they'll more than likely conjure an image of the stereotypical rider decked out head to toe in lycra. But that image owes much more to marketing than reality. With us is Dr. Tim Welch, a senior lecturer in urban planning at the University of Auckland. Dr. Welch, kia ora.
Thank you for having me.
It is true, isn't it, that when many think of cyclists, they do think of the lycra, the wrapped sunglasses, the stopping en masse for lattes, maybe of a certain demographic, right?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, most people think of a pretty high-end cyclist. They don't think of the everyday commuter, the moms taking their kids to school or whatever else. Gets a pretty bad rap.
You say that in the 60s and 70s, the market was full of cheap and reliable steel 10-speed bikes. I came a little bit later than that, but I still remember those 10-speeds around in the Rally 20s. How was cycling viewed then? Give us a bit of a comparison.
Yeah, I mean, cycling was then a bit, had its own issues then as well. I mean, there was a time when people were arguing that cyclists shouldn't be on sidewalks or roads either, but it wasn't viewed as, you know, this expensive sport. It was more viewed as just people getting from point A to point B. And so in the 70s, there were a lot of arguments about where bikers should be and where they shouldn't be. And then it kind of evolved into, from just kind of a mode of transportation to, as I mentioned in the article, a sport, whether you're on the mountains or a high-end triathlon or something else like that, and lost its focus on just another one of those tools to get you around the city.
You busted a few myths. I'll come to you, Mary Margaret. There's one more from here. You busted a few myths here, and that one was, for example, and there are many, it's not exclusively in the domain of Parkia in Aotearoa, that cycle.
What's that?
It's one of the myths is that it's not just European Parkia that cycle. It's a broad section, cross-section, it's a diversity of people that cycle here in New Zealand.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it really is. It's, everybody from South Auckland to North to wherever you look is on a cycle one way or another. So it's definitely not just for higher-income neighborhoods. Okay. You'll find basically any walk of life on a cycle if you get out there and actually get on a cycleway.
That's
from day
right.
to day.
If you ride it, you know who's there, don't you? Right. Dr. Kirsty Wild recently tweeted a graph depicting the relationship between deprivation and bike riding, and it's very consistent across the socioeconomic ladder. I wonder what you think, Tim. We make a really conscious effort at Bike Auckland to call them people on bikes, not cyclists, because it's all kinds of people who ride bikes. What do you think why has the media so happily jumped on to manufacturing consent of bike lash and isolating people on bikes to be not human but a cyclist in the mode that they choose?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question. I mean, it's been a perception for a long time that people on bikes or cyclists are there to kind of take the space away from cars. And so that's kind of an easy trope to pick up on, that the more cyclists we have, the fewer car spaces we'll have. We'll lose our lanes, and then we'll be stuck in traffic while the people on bikes just zip by. And so the other issue is that typically bike riders are the minority, right? We definitely see a lot fewer riders than we do people in cars. So it's easy to kind of minimize that group of people who typically are less visible than the ones that have been around in SUVs or whatever type of car that are kind of clogging the roadways throughout the day.
Well, I'm not a cyclist myself, so I actually sort of got in touch with a friend of mine, a husband of a regular panelist, Matt, who is quite a keen cycling advocate. And his comment is that he's adamant cycling is not elitist. He says you do occasionally right. See the flash buggers in the Lycra on their expensive bikes. But he's adamant. He said most people are simply using this as a means of getting from A to B. It is a form of transport.
And a very affordable one at that.
Yeah, yes. And he said the cycling groups he's seen, they cater for all abilities. He says, as he points out, it's like any other social or fitness activity. But for some reason, we've decided to pick on them. And to be fair, middle-aged men in Lycra are the most phenomenally easy target. And if you're latching onto that and making that your argument why you're going to give these people a hard time, then you're on pretty thin ice.
Sure. Mm. And when we think about the importance of commuting and under a climate emergency, getting out of your car if you are able to, it's probably worth commending a lot of the people who are choosing to ride their bike
right.
to work.
Yeah. It is interesting, isn't it? Because I just was so... You've got to have a look at... you go to the conversation and have a look at this article by Dr. Tim Welch here on the perception of cycling being elitist. So how do you think... Will it change? How are we going to be seeing... I was interested in your comment about people on bikes rather than cyclists, because it's quite extraordinary whenever you talk about the subject, Tim, it, for whatever reason, it's become quite divisive.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a...
Well, that wasn't like that in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a way, it's such a mundane activity. I mean, it's literally just getting on a bike. But people have a big problem with it. And it, again, comes back to this kind of car culture. That it's not just in New Zealand, it's not just in Auckland, but it's around the world. I mean, but if you want to pinpoint in New Zealand, we're number three in terms of the number of cars owned per capita, something like 800 cars per 1,000 people. So you have a massive car ownership issue, and so it's easy to kind of get a lot of people against the cyclists who are much smaller in numbers.
Sure. And simultaneously, 60% of Aucklanders say they would ride a bike if it was safer to do so.
Okay.
So it's been time that we build the infrastructure for them.
All right, thank you very much, Dr. Tim Welch. Kia ora, thank you for being with us on the panel.
You would have loved what I used to see when I lived in Japan, yeah. Just outside Tokyo. And along with like half the city I lived in, I would cycle to the train station every morning. And there were dedicated car parks. And I would drop my bike off and they give me a little chit and I'd go in. And when I came back, they'd give me a little ticket back. And there was a great big sort of elevator type thing. And they'd pull my bike out. It was absolutely brilliant.
Amazing.
It was normalised. It's what everyone did.
I hope that we get that at Britomart train station.
But unfortunately, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of sprawling out suburbs. If you live out in, say, Botany or Dannemora, one of those places, where are you cycling to or from? You're on great big wide open highways fighting against the traffic. We need smaller towns and smaller suburbs where people can ride safely.
And a citywide network.
Yeah. Now, great news for Cantabrians and Northlanders finally on the panel. Both Christchurch and Northland have made Time magazine's list of the world's greatest places for 2021. They're among good company, and a list that includes Tokyo, Paris, Savannah, Georgia, New York, New Orleans. The magazine, for example, praised Christchurch for its transformation following the city's devastating 2011 quake, saying, quote, its transformation can be best viewed with a walk along the new 1.2-mile Otokaro Avon River Promenade. So to discuss is former mayor of Ototahi Christchurch, Gary Moore, and self-described South Island enthusiast, Gary, kia ora.
Kia ora. Well, and you've missed out. Cyclist.
You're a cyclist, Gary?
I am. I bike everywhere, and I'm trying desperately, as a vintage car nut, to reduce my carbon footprint. So I ride everywhere.
Power all right. To you.
Yeah. Okay, so to Christchurch being on the Time magazine's list of the world's greatest, the cynic might go, really?
Well, we're probably one of the newest cities in the world, because a good proportion of Christchurch has been rebuilt. Mm. And we've got very safe housing. A lot of our housing is now really, affordable compared with other parts of New Zealand. We've got, the complete city's got carbon network, a fibre optic network to keep us up with the world. It's a really great place to live.
And I must admit, seeing some of the images reminded me of how, I've always had a soft spot for Christchurch, but next level, some of these places that was highlighted. Mary Margaret.
I haven't been to Christchurch since I was 7 years old, so pre-earthquake. No. That's the only time that I've ever been, so it sounds like I need to get back.
Yeah, absolutely.
You do. And look, honestly, it's a wonderful place to bring up your kids. It's a wonderful place. Like, we're now in the grandparent category. But the schooling's great. People are starting to get their mojo back. It took quite a while. And now people are feeling pretty positive. Yeah, sooner or later. Remember, we got called the People's Republic of Christchurch because we stuck one finger in the air towards the business round table. And I think the People's Republic will come back sooner or later. And there's quite a lot of younger business people are setting up in Christchurch, and that's really, really good.
Absolutely.
Because they fill the schools, they fill the economy, I'm feeling pretty positive about the
place.
Steve? Well, I'm ashamed to admit that I've never actually been to Christchurch.
Whoa!
But I'm going to make a valid excuse, to be fair. I arrived in New Zealand shortly before the big earthquake, and it occurred to me the best thing I could do was not bother Christchurch. I didn't need to be going down there and getting in the way. It occurred to me there's a city that was trying to rebuild itself. I thought, I'll give you guys a bit of time, and then I'll come down and... Is it time now, Gary?
When you come to Christchurch, get in touch with me and I'll loan you my bike.
You're on.
Listen to this.
Definitely, mate.
What a Friday pan. What a lovely way to
end.
Hey, fine, before you go, a couple of things that we must go and see if we are visitors to Ototahi.
Well, I would definitely go and see Turanga, which is our new library, which is just world class. And the town is so proud of it. It's fantastic. And then... The walkway from the centre of the city out to the sea, that's going to be a green spine that the whole of the world will be jealous of.
Wow, cool.
If you want to leave town, there's lots of places to ski and tramp and all that. We're not far from everything.
You've definitely talked me into it, Gary. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. Give me a ring and I'll get the bike polished.
You're on.
That's it. Gary, lots more questions I wanted to ask you actually about on the cathedral and the new stadium, but we'll have to leave it there. Gary Moore there, former mayor of Ototahi Christchurch. It sounds like you both need a bit of a re-excursion to the South Island.
You're on, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Panel trip.
A panel trip.
Yeah.
So we could just argue more about rewarding good service, and maybe I would go in and put down a big fat tip, and you both would just not,
okay.
Right?
Well, Wallace, it's not arguing. We simply explain to you while you're wrong.
While you hand out your ginger nuts.
Have a great weekend. Mary Margaret Slack, Stephen McCabe, kia ora. Thank you very much. I'm Wallace Chapman, back Monday, 3:45.
Ka kite. Love you.